Tantal Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Hanged Man by P. N. Elrod, narrated by Gabrielle Baker. Prologue, in which vital history concerning Her Majesty is revealed. When informed at the age of 10 that she was likely to be Queen of England, it was reported that Her Royal Highness, Princess Alexandrina Victoria of Kent, replied, "I will be good." What she actually said was, "I will do good." Sometime in 1835, it is a well-kept secret, the 16-year-old princess escaped her highly managed routine and spent 2 weeks walking incognito among commoners. The revelation of how ordinary folk lived and died made a profound impression on young Drina. She resolved to improve the lot of her people, especially that of women. During this taste of freedom, she met the dashing Lord Arthur Godalming, who was in the right place at the right time to rescue her from street ruffians. It was love at first sight for both, and when she became queen 2 years later, iron-willed Victoria defied custom and changed law so she could marry a peer rather than a prince. The love match of Victoria and the Lord Consort Arthur marked the beginning of a new era of enlightenment for England. Her progressive policies, particularly the historic Time of Women Equal Franchise Act of 1859, which granted voting rights to women, changed the world. The young monarch made her childhood declaration a reality. Victoria's empire now circles the globe, but the brass and steam progress of the Industrial Revolution disturbed dark forces. Reason and science were in vigorous conflict against fear and superstition. The Empress could not ignore the fact that something was supernaturally rotten in the state of England. In 1847, she called for the creation of a new department within the Ministry of Science. This special branch, Her Majesty's Psychic Service, dedicated to investigating all matters supernatural, employs the psychical gifts of those who serve in it to protect and preserve the realm. Here follows the story of one of her agents. Chapter 1, in which Miss Pendlebury is called to duty. London, England, Christmas morning, 1879. No commonplace death would require Alex's presence at such an ungodly hour. Calls to the house of a reader at 2 in the morning were never of a social nature. She girded her emotional barriers for the possibility of a brutal murder and sent up a silent request that it would not involve a child. Those were the worst, though, of course, none were ever pleasant. Someone rang the front entry bell just as she was about to put out her candle and attempt sleep. Mrs. Harris, the housekeeper, was away, visiting relations for the holiday, taking along the page and the maid, so Alex herself slipped downstairs. She did not bother with slippers, throwing a blanket about her shoulders against the chill. A man's looming form showed through the door's frosted glass panels. He was too tall to be Sergeant Green, who must also be away visiting family. Everyone had a holiday, except herself, the luckless fellow sent to fetch her, and Death. She used her candle to light the gas sconce, instantly brightening the foyer. Wary for problems, she slid open a discreet drawer in the foyer table where she kept a revolver. Clutching the blanket to her throat, Alex threw the bolt with her free hand and opened the door to the freezing night. "Miss Pendlebury," said the tall man on her step, "you're needed." The stranger held out a folded paper and, after his initial glance, looked at some point above her head, politely not noticing her state of dishabille. "He did not mistake me for a housemaid," she thought, sliding the drawer shut on the revolver. Why is that? Not from the blanket or what was visible of the nightdress under it. Then she remembered that no respectable servant would venture forth barefoot and without a cap or dressing-gown. Only the master or mistress of a house would do so. This was Baker Street, not Grosvenor Square. Therefore the master or mistress of a house were not above answering their own. She cut that thread of thought and took the paper. Scrawled in pencil was a Harley Street address and the name of the detective in charge of whatever investigation was presently taking place. Inspector Lennon, the toughest of a surly lot. He'd be in a fine temper, getting called in at this hour. He'd want things wrapped up quick to have the coming day free for Christmas dinner with his family. Alex had a surfeit of relatives herself, but no intention of dining with any of them. A cold supper, hot cocoa, a good book, and sweet solitude by a crackling fire suited her better. That, and not being called to read A Suspicious Death. She abruptly noticed it was sleeting, rice-sized beads collecting on her caller's shoulders and hair. "Oh, you must be frozen. Come in, Lieutenant." She stepped back to make room for him.
"Thank you, miss. Don't mind if—"
He got that look they always get.
"Beg pardon, but how did you—"
His regulation boots below his heavy ulster, hat tucked under one arm, and ramrod posture had given him away as a military man. She'd taken those in with her first glimpse, hardly aware of the process between observation and conclusion. While he could have been a sergeant, she added in his general manner, the cut of his hair, his carefully trimmed moustache, and, of course, his accent, placing him as a scion of an upper-class house who had found a place in the service. Whether he'd volunteered or had been transferred over as punishment for some infraction, such as passing the port in the wrong direction at dinner, she did not know or care. It would do no harm to add to her reputation. Alex preserved the mystery and made no reply. "I shall return directly," she said, pointing to a chair where he could wait.
"Yes, miss. They asked you to hurry, if you'll pardon my saying."
"They always do. But the dead are a patient lot, I think."
"Yes, miss."
He somberly agreed, this time not reacting to her knowledge that a death was involved. It was, after all, her trade. She did not rush upstairs, but once there she made a speedy toilet. Not knowing whether she'd be indoors or out, she prepared for the worst. Long woolens under her winter knickerbockers, a wool waistcoat over a wool blouse. Her new cycling boots that went up to her knees took forever to button, but once done, she was ready for anything. Alex descended the stairs smartly, pulling on gloves. Her driver rose, his mouth agape for an instant before he clamped it shut and assumed a studiously blank expression. She placed him as one of the vast number of males who still found females who chose to wear practical clothing to be an amusing, or even shocking, novelty. Punch printed many a cartoon in reaction to the transformations in fashion.
"Please, sir, we've had the vote for decades. Accustom yourself to fresher progresses," was the caption of one, showing Lord Nelson's statue swooning at the sight of two respectable ladies in trousers strolling Trafalgar Square. Alex bought several postcards of that one to share with a few female friends who would appreciate the humour. The emancipation the Equal Franchise Act gave to women had been the law of the realm for 20 years, but some men still grumbled about it, predicting the downfall of the British Empire, if not the end of the world, depending on the depth of their prejudice. So far, neither had happened, but Alex knew many lived on in hope, if only to have the satisfaction of saying,
"Ha! Told you so!"
She took her cape-topped ulster from the hook by the door and allowed her visitor to help her on with it. When he offered, he was simply showing common courtesy. Had he required similar assistance, she would have done the same. It would not have been easy. He was dashingly tall, while she was little more than a few inches over 5 feet in her boots.
"Thank you, Lieutenant?"
"Brooke,"
he said,
"attached to the service by special order,"
he added. That covers a number of sins, she thought. And by whose order? Alex transferred the revolver from the foyer table drawer to her coat pocket, which raised an eyebrow on her escort, But it, along with a notebook and other odds and ends, was part of her normal kit when on duty. Though not strictly required to carry one, all readers who dealt with criminal cases had to learn the use of firearms. Many times she'd been called to parts of London as dark and dangerous as any jungle, and she liked having the solid weight of a Webley on her person. She donned her fore and aft hunting cap, tying the ear flaps under her chin and wrapping a muffler about her throat. Whatever awaited tonight, she would not suffer unduly from the cold. Brooke held the door. She almost threw him a salute in passing, to find out if he'd return it out of habit. That would be inappropriate humour, given the situation. Instead, she went out, then locked up. Their conveyance was an ordinary hansom, not the unadorned closed carriage the service favoured. Her driver was much too finely turned out to pass as a London cabbie, though. I will have to send word upstream about that. There was a fresh crop of New Year recruits to train, and none of the upper-class ones, including their hide-bound instructors, had the least idea how to blend into the vast background of commonplace London life. Brooke was evidently one of them. A cabbie with an Eton accent? Quite ridiculous. Alex climbed in, pretending to overlook the lieutenant's offered hand. Yes, definitely from some high stratum. His mother, or more likely his nanny, had taught him nice manners. Well and good. Alex appreciated nice manners. Had she been in a dress, she would have accepted help, but the ease of movement her cycling costume allowed abrogated the need. Brooke put on his hat and touched the brim, and the cab rocked as he climbed up to the driver's seat. She pulled shut the half-doors that would protect her from some of the wet, and heartily wished for a more sheltering conveyance. Sleety wind stung her face as they trotted north along Baker Street, then cut right into Marylebone Road, heading for the northern end of Harley Street. London was usually clogged with all manner of vehicles, but not at this hour of night. Their trip was miserable, but brief. Brooke pulled the horse up just short of the house. There was a hospital ambulance already waiting in front, and two men hunched in its lee, smoking cigarettes. They couldn't remove the body until she had a look at things. Even in this weather, a few idlers hung about, hoping for a glimpse of something interesting, or to earn or beg a copper. A constable kept them at a distance. Every window with a view of the street had one or more faces in it, taking in the show like theatre attendees in private boxes. How long has this been going on? She preferred to arrive at the scene of a death as soon as possible, nearly always before the ambulance. Things were easier to read when the residual emotions were uncontaminated by intrusive traffic or eroded by the passage of time. There were strict rules of preservation in place now, but not everyone followed them. Investigations had a pattern. Discover a body, notify a doctor or a constable, depending on the circumstances. If there was anything suspicious about the death, clear the area and send for a detective from Scotland Yard and a reader from Her Majesty's Psychic Service. Tonight, Miss Alexandrina Victoria Pendlebury happened to be the closest. Lieutenant Brooke dropped down, one of his heels slipping on a patch of ice. He grabbed the hansom and kept his balance. This time she accepted his hand as she emerged. "Have a care, miss," he advised kindly. Would that be for the sidewalk or for what waited inside the house? She was familiar with the locale, often cycling along Harley Street, taking the air when the weather was temperate. The house was part of a row of impressive structures, each 4 stories tall with 3 dormers at the top, each made individual by the use of different colours of brick. They were wonderfully respectable and, despite high rents, much in demand by members of the medical establishment. This one's wide door with frosted glass panes was very like her own. It was also noteworthy for being between 2 large bay windows, one for its own building, the second belonging to the neighbouring house. The lower facade of number 138 was of fine white stone, with a faux Roman arch trimming the fanlight window. The metalwork screen on the fanlight, the elegant iron fence on either side, and the brass knob in the centre of the door were all nearly identical to the front of her own house, but on a grander scale. The keystone of the arch had a distinctive carved head, like a death mask, emerging from its surface. That was new. She'd have noticed such a thing on her last jaunt here some 3 weeks ago. Prior to that, the building had been vacant for about a fortnight, so the new tenant had been here less than a month and had money to spend on exterior decorations. She wanted to ask who lived here, but that could wait. The service was strict about investigative process, and rightly so. They caught more criminals that way. Inspector Lennon opened the door. Gaslight spilled out, catching on specks of sleet flying past.
"Finally," he growled, looking her up and down. "Get inside and get on with it."
Despite tangible results that came from readings, Lennon maintained a broad scepticism tinged with contempt for those with psychical talent, but followed official procedure to the letter. One could not lodge a complaint against that, however poor his manners. "Good morning, Inspector," she said, mounting the three steps and entering, unruffled at being addressed like a lazy scullery girl.
"Nothing good about it, Miss Pendlebury, as you'll find out."
"Please, no information. Just tell me where." She removed her muffler and cap, stuffing them into her pockets, then took off her gloves.
"Upstairs, last room on the left."
Unbuttoning her ulster, she had a quick look around, unsettled by the similarity of the house's exterior to her own. The foyer was somewhat different, this one panelled in dark, shining wood, not bold, cheery wallpaper. To her left was a sizeable parlour with chairs and tables along the walls. The draperies on the bay windows were closed. The parlour obviously served as a waiting room. She could assume a doctor owned the premises, and that he might be a bachelor or widower. A framed print on the wall extolling the virtues of Dr. Kemp's throat elixir supported it. No lady of the house would have that up, even in the public receiving areas. It was frightfully common. "Where are the servants?" Alex asked.
"The old lot's back in the kitchen."
Lennon nodded toward a door under the stairs that must lead to that area.
"We got them clear soon as may be."
She heard voices and clamour. Someone sobbing, someone else clattering about with pots and pans, probably seeking solace in the familiarity of work.
"Inspector, would it be possible to have a cup of tea for me when I'm done?"
He grunted and looked at Brooke, who had shadowed her inside.
"My men are busy. You see to it."
The lieutenant might have wanted to watch her at work, but said,
"Yes, sir,"
and went off. Imagine that, a member of the upper class fetching tea. The service was a great leveller. To his credit, Brooke gave no indication the task was beneath him. Sergeant Green, born and raised in Whitechapel, would have balked, but only because he'd consider it woman's work. Alex left her ulster on the banister and climbed the stairs with Lennon a few steps behind. He was a big man. They creaked under his boots. His hard gaze would be on the back of her neck, suspicious for any sign of weakness. She'd heard from others in her department that he took pleasure in intimidating them. He never said a word, letting a hard stare do the job of breaking their concentration. Complaints were lodged, but never went far. What could one say that would not sound like childish whining? Ignoring his presence, Alex opened to the atmosphere of the house. It was surprisingly buoyant. Most doctors' offices had quite an awful mix of hope and despair, the latter being the natural result of patients getting bad news about their health. The darker, heavier feelings tended to be stronger, soaking into the walls like a case of damp. Those could be dispelled easily. Sometimes simply airing a room was sufficient. However rare sunshine was in English weather, especially in winter, There was always enough to scour most places of old emotions. She reached the landing and focused on the left-hand door at the end of the hall. Move slowly. Test the way. Sometimes there were nasty emotional jolts lingering near a death, the psychical equivalent of stepping on a nail. So far, she picked up a general feeling of shocked disbelief, deep grief, and horror. She'd encountered those before, the normal residue left by those who found the body. People tended to have the same emotions when death paid a call. While she could not say that she was used to such, they no longer overwhelmed her. On her very first case, she'd opened up too quickly and fallen over in a faint. The instructor had been prepared. Alex struggled awake to the burning sting of smelling salts in her nose and was sharply told to show greater care for herself. She got no more sympathy than a medical student fainting at their first anatomy lesson. Of course, those students made a choice to become doctors or nurses. If unable and unwilling to handle the necessary requirements of their art, they could find another occupation. Alex had been born to this particular work. As with others possessing psychical talent, it ran in her family, and she had been blessed, or cursed, with a particularly strong ability. Her choices had been to learn to control it or go mad. Perhaps I'm mad and no one's noticed yet. She always thought that just before looking on a corpse. It was a tired observation, long bereft of its feeble humour, its very weariness a comforting affirmation that she was in her right senses. She paused before the door, which was ajar. The gas was on within, and strange shadows swung lazily on the hall floor. She pushed gently forward to see what cast them. The taint of night soil hung heavily in the air, turning her stomach. In all the stories and books she read for pleasure, none of the writers ever made mention of this noisome aspect that attended the discovery of a corpse. Either they'd never dealt with death themselves, or deemed the subject indelicate. Alex kept handkerchiefs in a jar of rose water on her dressing table. Just before leaving on a call, she'd wring one out, tuck it into an oilcloth pouch, and tuck that into a pocket of her waistcoat. She retrieved the one she'd taken tonight, holding it to her nose, then pushed the door wide. It was a room for a gentleman, furnished with a big bed and a reading chair by the window. There had been a fire in the grate. A few coals glowed, but offered no warmth. A window was raised high, and the air was freezing. Otherwise, everything was normal, except for the man's corpse hanging from the gas chandelier in the centre of the room. His back was to her, which made it easier. However they died, she avoided looking at their faces. After burnings and drownings, hangings were the worst. The last one, with its bulging black tongue, bloodshot eyes popped wide, and horrifically elongated neck, would last her a lifetime. Alex had no need to look anyway. Her job, God help her, was to feel. A suicide? The chandelier must be singularly sturdy to hold such a weight. Then she noticed the rope was looped over the same large hook in the ceiling that held the light. The hook had been driven deeply into a support beam, hidden by plaster, certainly strong enough to carry out an act of self-destruction like this. The chief grotesquerie was that the gas yet burned. The body, so near to the source of light, cast a deep shadow upon the floor and walls. The man's grey head was against one of the glass globes. While still alive, he must surely have flinched from the heat. Why had he lighted the gas? Why not that candle on the bedside table? While death occasionally possessed a macabre humour, it was never kindly, particularly with suicides who hanged themselves. The bowels and bladder had given way, which accounted for the bad smell. The rose scent in her handkerchief could not wholly overcome the reek, but it kept Alex from retching. His bare feet dangled loose and vulnerable under the blue nightshirt. A draught created by the open door stirred its pale folds. Otherwise, the corpse was quite still. His slippers were next to the bed, which was rumpled from occupancy. Had he crept under the covers to stare at the ceiling until unrelenting hopelessness caused him to rise and end his torment? While it was not outside possibility, there was a false note to the terrible scene before her. Several, in fact. If he planned ahead enough to bring a rope, why bother going to bed? There was no need to mislead the servants. As master of the house, he had only to shut the door and attend to his repugnant undertaking in private. Why undress for bed? While she had encountered suicides who stripped naked to meet their maker, most kept their clothes on. In one case, the lady put on her wedding dress and reclined prettily on a chaise longue, while a draught of laudanum took her into the next world. Why choose such a long, painful death by strangulation? If he had been a doctor, then there would be better choices in his medical bag. Laudanum, morphine, or heroin were painless and just as effective. Well, the initial discovery was out of the way. Time to get on with the rest of it. And there, perhaps, find answers. Murder victims tended to be surprised, terrified, or enraged, leaving those feelings behind in the wake of an attack, removing them from life. Those who passed due to accident often left nothing at all, if their death was sudden enough. She'd encountered that in the aftermath of a train wreck. A great number of the dead hadn't known what befell them, and all that remained were their poor broken bodies. Most of the emotions she'd gotten had been from those whose work was to remove and attend the dead. It had run to ghoulish humour. Ugh. Suicides, though, had weeks, months, even years of despair and anguish about them. It built up like silt in a river. It bogged them down, trapped them, tortured them until they finally succumbed willingly to end the pain. But hanging was a singularly agonizing way to die. It always took longer than expected. The pain, shock, and helplessness usually left an imprint of emotion as harsh as any violent murder. Alex opened herself a tiny bit more, bracing for the worst. But nothing came, which was not normal. She opened still more, eyes shut, and cast about like a hunting hound. There was the discordant rasping shock here in the doorway. That would be from the person or persons who had found the body. A servant had found him, male, his valet or butler. The horror and sincere grief were profound, but not the same sort one got from a relation or a spouse. A calm fellow, he'd likely seen death before and recognised it readily enough. A relative might immediately take down the body in an attempt to revive it or to conceal the self-slaughter. But this one had been left as found. The man was clearly dead. Nothing to do but alert the authorities. As for the room's late occupant, odd. There was no trace of melancholy at all, which puzzled her. Why, then, had this man killed himself? No emotional residue presented itself to answer. The only feelings here were of self-satisfaction, a sense of accomplishment, anticipation, not at all what she'd expected. If not suicide, then murder? But she found no trace of that either, unless that satisfaction belonged to the perpetrator. Not likely, for the emotion was well attached to the general atmosphere of the room, imprinted there by its most habitual occupant. The man had not killed himself, nor had he been awake to resist an attacker. He'd passed, unaware. Considering the agony of such a death, that was just as well, but it was impossible that he could have slept through it. Had he been in a drunken stupor? The attacker had left no sign of himself behind. Not one...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?